In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Ohio attorney Tom Rentz is bringing a federal lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of pandemic emergency declaration orders. If you didn't catch it, that interview, it's on the site inothernewsradio.com. And on that post, there are the documents, such as the complaint and a 627-page PDF of evidence. A big thank you to those radio stations that broadcast the show with attorney Tom Rentz, who gave fair warning that unilaterally ordered emergency declarations set precedent that can be exploited by potential tyrants down the road. One of the key issues is how federal, state, and local government continue to rely on the PCR test proven to have up to a 90% inaccuracy. Doctors have warned that the test can be triggered by genetic material left over from a weeks-old infection. That study is from the University of Oxford Center for Evidence-Based Medicine and the University of the West of England. What about the effectiveness of face masks? The CDC reports that in the 14 days before illness onset, 71% of case patients and 74% of control participants reported always using cloth face coverings or other mask types when in public. Why is it then okay for politicians and health officials to continually base their decisions to shut down economies on flawed testing data? Recently, the former head of the FDA and also the World Health Organization have essentially said that shutting down societies is not a strategy to end the spread of COVID-19. In the United States, more than 420,000 small businesses closed permanently from March to July, according to a recent Brookings Institution report. Michigan was known to have one of the highest COVID-19 infection rates in the country, and the governor imposed a stay-home, stay-safe executive order instructing people to only venture out for food, exercise, or medical reasons. The order also limited gatherings, travel, and required all workers who aren't necessary to sustain or protect life to stay home. But then the Michigan executive orders were extended, and similar to the Ohio case, our guest attorney David Helm challenged the constitutionality of the additional lockdowns based on the 5th and 14th Amendments. Attorney David Helm has practiced law in Michigan since 2010 and is from Novi, Michigan. He started his career in construction and owned several businesses. He joins us today to talk more about this case. Attorney David Helm, welcome to Another News.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you filed a lawsuit in the U.S. District Court in Detroit challenging Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer's second shutdown. In an interview with Newsweek magazine, you were quoted in describing the first executive order issued by the governor as, quote, targeted to the specific needs of the crises. But the second shutdown, quote, goes too far. Would you please give listeners an overview of how this case originated?
Yes. So when the coronavirus first hit America, Governor Whitmer, like many other governors across the state, started implementing emergency executive orders in her view to try to stem the tide or the spread of this. The original orders were not so restricting. However, subsequent orders, particularly the ones that were issued in April of 2020, became extremely more restricting. And by that point, it was a absolute lockdown of all individuals in the state, except with very limited circumstances. And it was because of that lockdown, broad lockdown, that I had many people reaching out to me. And we decided at that point it was time to take action. And we filed both the federal suit, and then after that we filed a state suit as well in the Court of Claims.
Many of the listeners may not be familiar with the state of lockdowns that occurred in Michigan. Would you elaborate on some of the breaches of constitutional rights related to the governor's emergency declaration?
Yeah, so one of the major things that that my clients had concerns was the blanket stay-at-home order. Essentially, you were quarantining the healthy as well as the sick. The governor was saying that you couldn't leave your home at all to engage in any activity unless it was physical in nature. Actually, it actually said that unless you were to go outdoors for physical activity, to go to the grocery store, or essentially to go to the doctors. That was the only time you were able to leave your home. It had gone so far as the governor instituting executive orders, literally banning the purchase of paint or seeds for your garden. You couldn't buy like a lawn chair or anything like that. They also, through the Department of Natural Resources interpretation of these executive orders, banned access to public lands, public campsites, public waterways, navigable waterways. There was an a rule invoked where you couldn't use power boats, yet human-powered water vessels were appropriate. So you could go sailing or kayaking, but if your sailboat had a motor, you couldn't do it, or you couldn't go fishing, anything like that. It also banned you from accessing any second homes or real estate that you owned, which prevented landlords from accessing their property that they owned and attending to their tenants, as well as people visiting their vacation homes. In fact, one of my clients was at their second home when the executive order went into place, and they had Michigan State Police stop by their home, or their second home, their cottage, and told them that they could not go back to home in Oakland County. They couldn't go back home. And then it also restricted people from working, period, unless you were what they said an essential worker, which they defined as somebody that worked in the like at a grocery store or a medical facility, something like that, regardless of how many people were working. So even if you had one person out there working, you couldn't do it. So you were restricted from all that. And basically, you were ordered to stay at home, except for a very small number of people. And that was the restrictions that we were under in April when both the federal and the state lawsuit were filed.
Then the second shutdown occurred. Can you talk about how that happened and maybe what the governor based the decision on?
No idea what the governor based the decision on, and that's part of the problem. We literally have no access to the data. We have no access to the people that were met with, the information that was shared, the reasons or justifications given. The governor had mentioned in many of her press conferences that she didn't want people traveling specifically because she didn't want to transmit COVID via gas pumps. She mentioned gas pumps at least 100 times, but no justification for that, nor a justification as to why eliminating travel entirely was more appropriate than, saying, putting sterilization or wipe-down stations at each gas pump like they did at the grocery stores. But we literally don't know why she decided to go this route, what her thinking was, what her reasoning was, what the data was that supported or didn't support this position.
That was an issue with Ohio Attorney Tom Rentz's case as well, and he's hopefully going to get to the discovery process to find more information about that. But regarding the Michigan lockdown emergency declarations, do you know of other states that had similar emergency declaration orders?
There are a number of states that did. And Pennsylvania, for example, had in New York, had very stringent lockdowns, just like we saw in Michigan. They also had them in Wisconsin as well. Wisconsin was struck down for the same reason that Michigan was struck down. Pennsylvania laws were struck down, or executive orders, as it were struck down for a different reason than what happened here in Michigan, but for the reason I was hoping would prevail in our particular case. And I want to elaborate. The federal claim that we brought was for a violation of the First Amendment, precluding people from association, and for a violation of the Takings Clause. The Takings Clause says that the government cannot take private property without just compensation. And our argument there was that by shutting down businesses and by restricting access to second homes, it was essentially a taking, and that my clients needed to be justly compensated, as well as restricting gatherings to only members of your individual household was a violation of the First Amendment. The state claim that we brought was a violation of what we alleged was a violation of your 14th Amendment due process rights, both substantive and procedural due process rights, as well as a challenge to the Emergency Powers Act, which gave the governor the authority to implement these executive orders. So the Supreme Court ruling that happened on October 2nd, what it did was the law, the Emergency Powers Act and the Emergency Governor Management Act, I forget the names of them exactly, those two acts are unconstitutional for various reasons, and therefore the governor cannot use those acts to implement her executive orders. What the court did not say, so essentially it's a separation of powers issue. They said that those two statutes unlawfully delegated legislative authority to the governor, which it cannot do. What our challenge was not that. It was a challenge of a violation of the Bill of Rights, essentially your fundamental rights, and without due process of law, and without it being the least restrictive means possible. The court did not rule on that in Michigan. The court only ruled that the statutes themselves, which allowed the governor to issue the executive orders, were in fact unconstitutional. So that's what happened in Wisconsin as well. Now, in Pennsylvania, it was different. In Pennsylvania, the federal court over there held that the executive orders, regardless of what law was used, were unconstitutional because they violated people's fundamental rights. That's the argument that we were pushing forward in our lawsuits, both of them, the federal and the state one. And that's the way the federal court in Pennsylvania ended up ruling. So hopefully that clarifies the two different angles and approaches here on these cases.
It does. I remember that ruling that came out from Pennsylvania about a month ago. Well, getting back to Michigan shutdowns for a minute, what types of hardships did you see or hear about related to the shutdowns in your state?
Well, you know, we monitor the statistics. You know, I'm in court every day as well. And domestic violence cases are up. Suicides are up. Depression is up. And divorces are up. Unemployment is up as well. There's many people unemployed. And many, many local small businesses are out of business and have gone bankrupt because the governor's actions, the blanket restriction and preventing people from work. Now, I understand that the federal government, as well as the state government, has extended unemployment benefits. There was the stimulus check that went out back in June, I think. But that wasn't enough to allow these companies to sustain businesses and these people to remain employed. And when you're trapped inside, it does something to you, mentally, I think. Because we were working on our cases against the governor, we weren't, myself personally, we weren't restricted. We weren't sitting in the house all day twiddling thumbs. But it did get trying sometimes. So it took both a mental and physical toll on these people as well as a financial toll, which Michigan is slowly recovering from.
The case that you brought, your clients have talked about their hardship, and it was more economic, I think, and then they're asking for damages. Is that correct?
So the federal case, we were asking for damages under the takings clause, in that they needed to be justly compensated. But my client's primary goal was not damages. When we filed the state case, we asked for an immediate injunction against the governor enforcing her executive orders. That was the primary goal. We wanted those executive orders lifted immediately. The governor was show-caused to present to the court why a preliminary injunction should not be issued right away. And within 24 hours of that show-cause, the governor overturned four of the five major issues we had as far as accessing public property, private property, accessing the public lands and waterways, utilizing motorized boats as well as non-motorized boats, allowing individuals to work if they were by themselves, such as landscapers, if you have one out there mowing a lawn. All of that was reversed by the governor within 24 hours of that show cause, but for the blanket stay-at-home order otherwise. That was the one that continued to move the case forward.
I see. Was there any understanding of the logic of the motorized boat versus the non-motorized boat and going to your second house? Is that just to stop people from moving around too much? It's some kind of curb human activity, or do you suspect something else is going on?
Well, it's funny enough. The public statements made by the governor, again, go back to the gas pump. If you're not traveling, you don't need to go to the gas pump. If you're not traveling up north, say from Southeast Michigan, that had the most cases, then you're not potentially spreading it up into areas that don't have cases or have very minimal cases. That was the stated idea, is to contain it where it is to the extent possible. And I would imagine the gas pump thing was the same logic with regard to using non-motorized boats. Motorized boats, of course, need gasoline. You got to handle gas pumps and the like, that sort of idea. Interesting that when Memorial Day rolled around, the governor opened up the upper part of Michigan and allowed motorized boats and marinas to open and a lot less restrictions. It just so happens that's where her summer place was. And there was a big scandal with her husband calling the place where they kept their boat to try to get it in ahead of everybody else's. I don't know if you remember that scandal or if you guys heard about it.
We did.
Yeah, yeah. So it was interesting that right before Labor Day, she opened up the northern part where her place is. So I don't know. I'd be speculating if there's any other motivation. And I'm not trying to say in this lawsuit that the governor had ulterior motivations. I know she had the eye on the VP nomination. I know, there's probably other political reasons going in there. But I don't doubt that to some extent they weren't trying to do what they thought was best. But the problem is that we haven't seen any data to back up any of their decisions. We haven't seen any information that could corroborate their assertions as to what would be appropriate response. And that's the biggest problem. And then on top of it, when the executive orders were held to be unconstitutional, she made a blanket statement that she's got 21 more days to enforce it, when that's not the law. She just basically committed contempt by just disregarding the Supreme Court. And so I think it might have started off with the right intentions, and it just went way too far and a little bit to her head.
Well, you're very forgiving, more than most people who criticize this governor. And regarding data, the information is out publicly available regarding the efficacy of the PCR test. What are your thoughts on that?
Speaking to the accuracy of tests, I mean, just anecdotally, I've known people that have gotten tests and came up positive, and then they've gotten second tests just to reconfirm, and it's come up negative 2 days later. So the accuracy of those tests in general, you can't trust. The other thing with regard to the numbers is there is a whole difference between contracting COVID and or being hospitalized or needing or dying from it. There's a huge difference between that. The other thing is that the numbers that are presented, they're not qualified in any way. When you talk about the number of deaths from COVID, they don't qualify the number by saying how many people would die normally or from other things at the same time. When they talk about the deaths from COVID, they don't qualify them as to whether or not they were contracted in nursing homes, which is a big issue here in Michigan, versus other people that were contracted. College kids, college campuses are being shut down because there's, 20 cases of it. But you're not shutting down for other things like measles, which has been growing, or the flu, which is, depending on the nature of the individual who contracts it, is just as deadly. So you need those qualifying factors and for any of these numbers to be looked at critically. And we're not seeing it. We're not seeing it in the public forum, and I haven't been able to get discovery in my case. So we can't see it even on the litigation end of it.
This is what Attorney Tom Rentz is trying to get in his case, in the Ohio case. He suspects they're hiding information because he wants to see what their data is. And if they're withholding it, why would they do that? It doesn't make sense. It seems like they would want to justify their decisions and show you the information that it was based on.
And that's getting into a very political issue versus a legal issue with regard to why they're hiding it. You know, if the information is not made available, then they cannot be second-guessed. Whenever I would file a motion or something in our case, the response would always include news clippings or statements from the World Health Organization's websites. It wouldn't include their exact data because then they can't be second-guessed on it. They can't be then cross-examined on it. So that would be the legal reason why they're not doing it. The other thing is Governor Whitmer passed an executive order which, you know, stayed any sort of FOIA request response indefinitely until the emergency had passed. So even if you're sending in a FOIA request outside of your court proceeding, you weren't going to get any answers. And she justified that by saying people are working remotely. They don't have access to the documents. And I feel like that's a very weak answer. We'll leave it at that.
To block FOIA requests is a little suspect. I mean, this is all remotely and electronic, and that's just attaching PDFs in an email. I don't think it's that difficult. I certainly don't know the full process, but it seems strange to me and suspect.
It does. It seems very suspect to me when they stopped the FOIA requests. Again, the justification for it was because people weren't working in the offices. They wouldn't have access to it. It's been 6 months now. Now, mind you, the executive order that blocked the FOIA requests are done with. They've been revoked by the Supreme Court. So in theory, you should be able to get FOIA responses now. But I have to imagine they're extremely backed up. So getting a response is still going to take months and months and months, even if they do respond. So that's the problem with FOIA at this point. So in regard to my case, we had filed a discovery request asking for the specific data that was that the governor utilized when instituting, for example, Executive Order 2020-21, Executive Order 2119, just various executive orders that implemented these stay-at-home provisions and other restrictions, as well as a list of the individuals she met with and when she met with them, again, when drafting and signing these executive orders. And in response, they filed a motion to stay discovery. In lieu of filing an answer to our case, the governor filed a motion to dismiss, claiming first and foremost, mootness, because by the time we got up to the Supreme Court and back with regard to our preliminary injunction, the governor had lifted her blanket stay-at-home order, so that was no longer actively enforced. And so they said, well, now the case is moot, dismiss it. And then while that motion is pending, they filed a motion to stay discovery, so I couldn't get any discovery going forward. I also had attempted to subpoena various members of her cabinet, and that was met with a threat to quash those subpoenas, and then ultimately the court stayed any discovery. So I have not been able to do any discovery whatsoever on this case.
What is your next step in this case?
So our case, all of our both of our cases, challenged specifically the executive orders. The executive orders now are unenforceable, and she can't bring them again, pursuant to the Supreme Court. So our case is essentially dead. However, we're not out of options. Our concern here is that the legislature or other departments can enact the same sort of draconian restrictions as the governor did with her executive orders. And in fact, they're starting to. The Department of Health and Human Services has passed a resolution or a rule invoking the prior executive orders with regard to masks and social distancing and other businesses not being in operation and banning the assembly of a certain number of people and all that, literally invoking the executive orders 2020-42 or whatever they may be, even though they've been found unconstitutional. So our position there is that the DHHS has in fact exceeded its legislative authority, its statutory authority, to implement these rules, and we'll be going after them. Local counties have been doing the same thing. They've basically been invoking the executive orders in their local ordinances, and we're looking to go after them as well. And now we also have the legislator who has to have a hand in further legislation going forward with regard to responses to COVID, to the extent that they stipulate, pass a law that restricts fundamental rights like the executive orders did, then we will be bringing another lawsuit. Because an elected legislator can trample fundamental rights just as much as a rogue governor can. So we're keeping an eye on the legislation legislator going forward. But right now we are bringing a case against the DHHS as well as various other counties that have implemented the same sort of restrictions.
Okay, thanks for going into detail. I'm just curious if you could still have any kind of legal movement in regard to attaining discovery.
Well, discovery is stayed until the court has made a ruling on the summary motion. Part of the summary motion is mootness. I think at this point the governor's going to win on mootness, although not for the reasons she wanted to. The executive orders that we challenge are non-existent at this point, and from that perspective, our case is moot. And so we're not going to get any discovery out of this case until after a ruling on summary. And I just don't see it continuing. The case is going to rule on a summary in our favor, but we do have the restrictions imposed by the DHHS, which is part of the agency controlled by the governor. And we're hoping to get access to that information that way, as well as we've sent out a number of FOIA requests as well.
David, in the Newsweek article about your lawsuit, the opinions in the comment section are very polarized. Let me read a few. One is, so, if the stay-at-home order, quote, infringes on their rights to visit property, would that also apply to road closures due to repairs? Both are temporary and for the common good. Here's another one. I hope they get laughed out of court. Another one. Requesting officially that people stay home to avoid spreading a deadly virus equals, quote, tyrant? Let me guess, you watch a lot of Fox News and likely listen to Rush Limbaugh. Another one. At some point, this enforced lockdown has hurt more than it helps, and at that point, and that point has now been reached, if not exceeded. Civil unrest is pointing this out to the obstinate governor. Best this overbearing governor take heed. And the last one here, what scientific study can she point to prove visiting a home someone owns, planting a seed, or getting a haircut is a health risk? None, because there isn't any. Stop the science hoax. David, what are your thoughts on the polarizing opinions of this lawsuit and generally to legal protection against constitutional violations?
So what I think people are misunderstanding is, well, first of all, with the road closure thing, they're not restricting your access to private property with the road closure. Even if the road is closed, you can still access your private property. And with the whole equating this to a deadly virus, I would say, again, you need to put it in the context. Is it really that deadly? There's a great quote from a Swedish scientist who was the head of the epidemiology department there in Sweden, and I believe is now part of the World Health Organization because of what Sweden actually did and how successful they were with COVID. And he said, if the flu was anew, if we didn't have the flu, he said, you know, every year around this time in the fall, we get these news reports, the flu season is coming, they predict X number of people dying from it, go get your flu shots, you know, wash your hands, stay like that. And, you know, oh, okay, we take it, all right, the flu's coming, the flu season's coming, no big deal. If the flu was new and we had never experienced it before, there would be the same sort of panic that we are experiencing with the COVID. And I think that's very telling. The deaths are equivalent to a severe flu outbreak, but we don't see panic in the streets. You don't see mass lockdowns. You don't see businesses being ordered to shut down. And people, unfortunately, are susceptible to new, novel, scary things. And I think that's what you're seeing here, is that because it's new, because it's never been experienced before, people are scared of it. Whether that scare is justified or not is still up for interpretation. I don't believe that it is. I've seen the numbers that we have, comparing them with severe flu epidemics and comparing them with what Sweden has done. I don't think this sort of mass panic is warranted, but you do have people that are scared of this. I have friends that are personally scared of this, and more so than I am, but I think that's human nature, and I think that's what you're seeing on this divide. The problem is, with regard to protecting your constitutional rights, is that once the rights are lost, they are extremely hard to recover. And when we're talking about a government infringing upon people's rights, it is no less important during a normal day, a normal situation, than when we have a crisis. A great example is the Japanese internment camps, which were just recently struck down. But that was in the midst of a war. There was panic, and they were held to be constitutional because of the panic and because of people's fears. That's why they were held to be constitutional at the time. Now, we look back at this, and particularly in Trump v. Hawaii case, distinguished from that line of cases involving the Japanese internment camp, and said, it's a great shame of ours, and in no way, shape, or form should this have ever been allowed to stand. But that's looking at it from hindsight. And that's what people need to do at this point, is they need to look at this from a distance and look to see if giving up the rights that the government is compelling you to give up is essential at this point, or are we just dealing in fear of the unknown? And I think that is the big separator between people who are in favor of these restrictions and those that aren't.
Has your firm experienced harassment as a result of these lawsuits?
I wouldn't call it harassment. We've definitely gotten negative feedback. If you look at my Google reviews, there have been people, comments on there that I've never been clients. I don't know these people, but they're telling me, or they're telling the Google viewers how horrible of an attorney I am and things like that. We've also gotten letters in the mail. I was called a commie bastard at one point, and stuff like that. They all made the refrigerator. I like reading those. I find them more amusing than harassing, but there are definitely negative comments. We also have praise, though. We have letters that come in. People have volunteered money to help pay for this. I get people that come in and thank me for standing up for their rights and sent checks in. And we don't cash those checks, so we politely refused them, and we were very appreciative of them. But so we've gotten it from both sides, really.
Yeah, I was curious about that. And is there a logic to their critique? Do you see a rationality?
No, in the vast majority of them. The vast majority of them seem to be responding based purely on emotions, especially the one that called me a commie. Or a communist, some call me Nazi, things like that, which to me, if you look at it from a realistic standpoint, it's the exact opposite. We're trying to maintain the freedoms of individuals rather than like what the Nazi regime did. And so I can tell it's from a purely emotional standpoint. Some of the other comments are, why are you challenging like the mask thing? When it's very easy to put on a mask, and has the potential to save lives, why challenge it? Why? What's the issue with it? And it, they try to come at it from a logical point of view to some extent, but a vast majority of them are, they seem to be very emotional responses.
You were mentioning some of this, but our past guest attorney, Tom Rantz, was concerned about a precedent being set by local and state politicians in regard to emergency declarations. If you could elaborate a little bit more on your concerns about that.
Yeah, definitely. Once the executive orders with the mandatory stay at home and the other restrictions that were lifted that we originally filed against, once they were lifted, we continued to press forward with our case. And a lot of people, including the governor, said, why are you pushing forward with your case? This is now a moot issue. And our position was, and still is that we want to be able to make sure that we set precedents here, that it is not okay to enact these types of restrictions. Now, We have laws in place dealing with specifically with communicable diseases and individuals who have communicable diseases that are part of our health code, and it allows local health agents to identify individuals that have a communicable disease, get treatment for them. If they refuse treatment, then to get a court order to compel treatment and all these things. And you need reasonable suspicion or articulatable facts that a person has contracted it and can spread it to somebody else, contracted specifically a deadly communicable disease. With that, we wanted to see some sort of reasonable suspicion that an individual has it before you can order them to self-quarantine in their home. You can't order the entire quarantine of the state because you're scared. That's essentially what we wanted the court to say, that you need specific and articulatable facts to quarantine an individual or put any sort of restrictions on a business. And you also must take action that is the least infringing action possible. You know, the best example is the gas pumps. Instead of telling every state resident that they cannot travel, why not order gas stations to put wipe-down stations and hand sanitizers at the pumps? That seems a lot more logical and reasonable. You're doing it with grocery stores already. Why can't you do it with gas stations? So that's sort of the precedence that we wanted to be able to set, so that people couldn't do this. Governors, whatever party they are, or the legislator, whatever party controls it, can't implement these types of things in the future.
Right. How would that work if someone gets in a position of leadership in one of the three branches in Michigan State, whether they're the governor or they're in the legislative branch, and the emergency declaration orders have not been challenged like you're doing? How can they be abused?
Well, they can be abused by doing exactly what the governor did. I mean, she essentially took a law that said, I can invoke executive orders under an emergency. I can declare an emergency. Then I can redeclare it every 28 days, and I don't have to involve the legislature at all going forward, and I can essentially be a dictator. That's how it gets abused, and that's exactly what happened. And mind you, this isn't the first time the this particular governor has done this. Back in October of 2019, there was a statewide ban on vapes. The ruling or the rule banning them was implemented by the Department of Health and Human Services, and the justification for it was that there was an emergency in that young children were getting their hands on vapes, and that they needed to be banned outright immediately. And the governor used her emergency powers to ban vapes across the state. There was a federal lawsuit filed, and the federal court said, strike that. It might not have been a federal case. It might have been a state case. Either way, the court said that that was basically an unlawful exercise of the emergency power that she had under the law, because it wasn't technically an emergency. And if you wanted to ban vapes through the Department of Health and Human Services, you needed to go through the normal rulemaking process, which was, establish a committee, get public comments, get expert comments, go through all of this. You couldn't just declare an emergency. And the governor did the exact same thing the following February and March with COVID. So this is a particular governor who doesn't have a problem doing whatever she feels like doing. And until there's checks put on her, she's going to continue to do it. The amazing thing was with this particular governor, after the October 2nd Supreme Court ruling, which ruled her executive orders unconstitutional, she declared that she still had 21 days that she can enforce her executive orders. That's not what the law says. That's not what the court rules say. The court rules say that a Supreme Court order is effective immediately. Now, she had 21 days to file a motion for reconsideration, but that did not change the effective date of it. But she went out there and declared it, that she still has 21 days and that her executive orders are in effect for 21 more days, and caused mass confusion around the state. Businesses didn't know if they had to require masks. People didn't know if they had to wear masks. People didn't know if any of her executive orders were still in force and effect because of her actions. because of her statements, which were completely contradictory to law. And again, the Supreme Court ruled just the other day, I believe 2 days ago, that said, no, we are not reconsidering your thing, and our orders are effective immediately. And so put finally a quash on that. So there's nothing to protect, or to prevent, I should say, an individual rogue governor, county executive, county sheriff, the attorney general, anything like that, from trying to do something. They have to be checked by the courts. And that's why these cases, mine and the dozens of others that have been filed, are so important. It puts the checks on the governors, on the legislators, on the counties, on the departments.
These checks, do they have permanency going forward when politicians such as Governor Whitmer leave office?
They do, because these lawsuits are not against the individual, they are against the office. So we sued Governor Whitmer in her official capacity. Anyone who takes over that office will be bound by the order of the court in their official capacity.
Recently, there was news that the Michigan governor and secretary of state said they likely won't be able to provide definitive election results on election night due to a lack of personnel to tabulate ballots. What are your thoughts on this recent news?
Well, my concern here is that the law is clear that election day takes place on one day. Now, in the past, when we have mail-in ballots, absentee ballots, and things like that, when we've allowed it for military and elderly and whoever else would qualify for it, those ballots must have been counted prior to election day so that they can be included in the count on election day. Election day, again, is one day. Anything that goes beyond that one day is in clear violation of the law. That's the major problem with that. So it's a clear violation of law. Why they are doing it, the reasons for it, it gets deep into politics, which I'm sure you've discussed before. But it's just a direct violation of law. There's been court challenges out there. And I don't know the status of those cases just yet with regard to ballot tabulation. But if it goes beyond Election Day, it's a violation of law. Election Day is one day.
It seems that this governor is certainly one of the most controversial that Michigan has had.
We've always had controversial governors. You know, Rick Schneider was sued over the Flint water crisis. Governor Granholm, prior to him, had a lot of policies that people thought were extremely unfavorable. You know, Governor Engler before her had his ups and downs. At times he was popular, at other times he wasn't. But this is the first governor that I can recall, and even I've been a student of Michigan history for a while, where there's almost a dictator quality to her. That I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and if you don't like it, then good, challenge me. And until I get told I can't do it, I'm going to do it. This is the first governor that I've seen like this ever.
Attorney David Helm, the Davos meeting text on their site reads, "There's an urgent need for global stakeholders to cooperate in simultaneously managing the direct consequences of the COVID-19 crisis. To improve the state of the world, the World Economic Forum is starting the Great Reset Initiative. Have you looked at how other countries are violating the rights of their citizens during pandemic lockdowns?"
Yes. So the Bill of Rights, fundamental rights, are unique to the United States. However, there are a myriad of other countries that invoke similar, if not the same, sort of we'll say constitutionally protected freedoms. For instance, in Spain, just recently struck down the health minister's coronavirus restrictions. That was on last Thursday, and they held that that the restrictions were a violation of human rights. And I know like I mentioned before, Sweden has been very loose with their restrictions. They took an extremely different approach. So people's fundamental rights have not been impacted. I know there are challenges in Australia as well to the very draconian restrictions there. In fact, people can't leave their house for more than an hour. I haven't heard any outcome on that. But the challenges to the restrictions placed in Great Britain have been, it's seemingly working, but more from a political standpoint than a legal challenge standpoint. Now Britain is starting to shift more towards the model that Sweden has put together. So there's been some movement on that, particularly with Madrid last Thursday. Canada has really draconian restrictions as well, but I don't think there's been a whole lot of challenges to that. Plus, they have a different fundamental rights structure, which I don't believe allows for the same sort of challenges that we have in the United States. But I'm happy to see some movement in Europe and some changes in those policies. And the World Health Organization are starting to take some of those leads and hopefully recommending different changes.
Other legal challenges include those regarding mandatory vaccines or the efficacy of vaccines themselves. They don't even have to be mandatory. There's concern about what the vaccines actually contain and do to the human body. Would you please talk about your knowledge of some of the challenges to mandatory vaccines?
So when it comes to COVID right now, there are no laws mandating vaccines, primarily because we don't have any effective vaccines right now. And I heard recently that Johnson & Johnson just stopped their testing of the vaccine because several people were getting sick, really sick from it. So the likelihood of us having a vaccine anytime soon is slim. But there is definitely talk of making these vaccines mandatory. The problem with that is, from a constitutional point of view, is we have, I would say, a very bad ruling from 100 years ago called the Jacobson case. And that involved a mandatory vaccine dealing with smallpox. And there was an outbreak, there was quarantine areas, and there was a mandatory vaccine. That case has been cited by every governor in this country, saying that they have the authority to take all these draconian measures in order to stop the spread of COVID. And for the most part, this was a Supreme Court case. So for the most part, the courts have been upholding this, saying that this is precedent. It was specifically mentioned in the Pennsylvania case, though, and it distinguished Jacobson from today in that we have had a huge advancement on individual liberties since the Jacobson ruling 100 years ago. We have, in fact, even Roe v. Wade was a huge blow to what the principles set forth in Jacobson are. The principles set forth in Jacobson were that the vaccine is minimally invasive, it's been proven to be effective, and there is a dangerous communicable disease out there. And it also took into consideration, the mandate did anyways, of people's health and age, like they weren't vaccinating kids and or the elderly or people that were susceptible to, you know, becoming sick from the vaccine. It was only healthy adults that were being vaccinated. That was the Jacobson case. But since then, we have Roe v. Wade, which is, and its companion cases going forward from that, which are huge individual privacy cases involving one's privacy to their own body, to the extent that the government can't mandate vaccines the way they did under Jacobson 100 years ago. And to my knowledge, there are no mandatory vaccine laws right now. There are requirements, especially when you're talking about children and going to school, but there's also the waivers available and things like that, which used to be religious-based only, that you could get a waiver for it, but now it's been expanded to beyond just a religious challenge to the vaccines. And so since there are those laws, and since Jacobson is way out of date, and since we have Roe v. Wade and all the companion cases that go from there, I don't see a situation where the governments are going to be able to mandate vaccines. Even if we have a completely functional and completely harmless vaccine for COVID, I don't see it being mandated, at least not lawfully. And I would expect challenges, and we're prepared to challenge that if Michigan ever tries to impose such a mandate.
Well, hopefully someone from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is tuning in. There are a lot of civil rights violations riding on the back of this pandemic. And a recent example is the testing of Common Pass, a new technology designed to let passengers prove they've tested negative for COVID-19 before they fly. regardless of partisan politics, the work your firm is doing to legally challenge overreaching authority by political leaders is a critical action, especially when it's under a pretense of keeping people safe. Attorney David Helm, I want to thank you for being on In Other News.
No, I appreciate you having me on, and let me know if you want me back on anytime.
Indeed. If listeners want to reach out to you, how would they do that?
So you can go to my website, which is helmlawpc.com. That's H-E-L-M-L-A-W, P as in Paul, C as in Charlie.com. And our contact information is there. There's an email link as well as a phone number that they can call us at.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you being on the show.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
More and more people are starting to see the pattern, waking up, as it were, to the startling reality of how very likely the statistics of this pandemic are being manipulated as part of a long-term agenda, an agenda that's been discussed at length on this show. In a recent article on globalresearch.ca sent to me from Tom in California, who's been very helpful. Thank you, Tom. While mentioning people, thank you to Brian and Brandon in Long Island, Monique in New York City, Kent in New Jersey, the recent stations airing the show, and you, the listener. I appreciate the support. And back to the article titled Assaulting Science in the Name of Science, Exploring the Coronavirus of 2020 by Professor Anthony Hall. He writes, there's a battle going on over who and what most credibly represents science. As the months pass, the contest over science is integral to the acrimony concerning the nature of COVID-19. He writes, there's a battle going on over who and what most credibly represents science. As the months pass, the contest over science is integral to the acrimony concerning the nature of COVID-19. In February of this year, the UN's World Health Organization, an agency largely funded by Bill Gates, bestowed the name COVID-19 on the supposedly new coronavirus. Many powerful interests have combined to argue that science justifies the government-led initiatives to impose, for instance, economic lockdowns, social distancing, mandatory masking, and a future of compulsory vaccines. A growing international movement of people, however, is coming to see that the impositions being done in the name of fighting COVID-19 are not scientific at all. Instead, we are in the midst of a propaganda war aimed at inciting fear and even panic. Josh Middledorf has written an illuminating essay about the struggle over who really speaks on behalf of the scientific method. From his analysis, he concludes, quote, never before 2020 have so few people with so little scientific credentials claimed to speak for the scientific community as a whole, and never has the public been asked to modify their daily lives and sacrifice livelihoods on such a scale. Middledorf lists 10 of the lies and deceptions pushed on us without the backing of scientific authority. Here are the 10 messages that are essential pieces of the standard COVID narrative, but which are unfounded in actual science. Number one, the origin of SARS-CoV-2 virus was one of the many random events in nature in which a virus jumps from one species to another. That's a lie. Number two, chloroquine kills patients and is too dangerous to use against COVID. Number three, the Ferguson model warned us of impending danger and time to take action and dodge a bullet. Number four, American deaths from COVID are 200,000 and counting. Number five, new cases of COVID are expanding now in a dangerous second wave. That's a lie, considering the inaccuracy of the PCR test. Number six, mask and social distancing are keeping the virus in check in our communities. Number seven, Dr. Fauci and the CDC are guiding our response to COVID according to the same principles of epidemic management that have protected public health in the past. Okay, it's on this list, so it must be a lie. Number 8, asymptomatic carriers are an important vector of disease transmission, which must be isolated if we are to stop the spread of COVID. We now know that's not true. Number 9, the lower death rates now compared to April are due to protective measures such as social distancing, mask wearing, and limited travel. We know that's not true. Number 10, with enough resources, pharmaceutical scientists can develop a vaccine in a matter of months and provide reasonable assurance that it is safe. We know that's not true. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.